young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
In a trance, you fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone.
Why don't we call them working dads? That's a new report entitled Work-Life Balance, Working Father's Perspective. Finds men today are stuck between paradigms. Men are expected and indeed wanted to become more involved with their children, says Cameron Phillips, our guest. But the traditional role of breadwinner is still making that very different. Cameron's founder of Better Man Solutions surveyed working men and women for the report. He says the result was pretty clear. The unaddressed issue is that we still undervalue fatherhood and expect little will change for men in the workplace since once they become, Cameron, hi, welcome. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael, for having me on.
Oh, and thank you for being here. And the reason I say I can't figure out what they would become, dads always had a particular role. Now,
exactly.
The culture changed. And as the culture changed, dad had to change. What is it that's lacking with dad today as far as being home?
I think men are really sort of stuck between those traditional roles that you talk about and the emerging new roles, of course. In the 50s, if you worked hard and earned enough money so your spouse could raise the children, by society's definition, you were doing a terrific job as a dad. And I think we'll all pretty much agree that even though some families are more traditional than others and choose to do that, and if that works for them, so much the better. There are dads now who want to be more involved than just the disciplinarian. And I think the problem is you've got men who are sort of stuck in this. The breadwinning role is still so important to them, and they've seen essentially what's happened to women in the last 40 years when they've vocally tried to balance family and work. When women have, for the last 40 years, fought so valiantly to say to employers, "Look, you will take me seriously as a mother, and you will take me seriously as a career person," and then men have seen the way that women's careers have been somewhat sidetracked when they put family first, and so men, because that breadwinning role is still so important to them. There's this feeling of, I want to be home more with my kids. Yes, I'd like to be at the soccer game, or yes, I want to be at the piano recital, but, Harry keeps coming in every Saturday and Sunday afternoons, and if he does and I don't, then he gets that promotion and I'm letting my family down. So I think men are caught between these two paradigms, and unlike women, men aren't the first to stand up and talk about it.
And it's that caught between a rock and a hard place. But from what I'm seeing here, Cameron, the operative word is partner. What I'm looking at here, and stop me if I'm wrong, that the answer, the solution to this is creating a partnership between the husband, the wife, and getting the balance between the workplace and the two.
Exactly. And actually, timing is really interesting. There was another report released this week by the Boston College Center for Work and Family by Professor Brad Harrington, who's done extensive work in this area as well, and he was mentioning that in his survey, 70% of fathers agreed that the work should be shared, that partnership should be there, but only about 30% actually admitted to doing it. And again, I think that shows where we are out of balance. And I think part of the problem is it often just starts with a conversation at home. There's something that another writer, James Lipinski, talks about of the conspiracy of silence, that we make these assumptions. I'll give you an example. Billy's sick at school, and so the school assumes that, well, we better call mom at her job because her employer will be far more understanding if she's got to duck out of work and pick up Billy than Billy's dad's employer would be. Now maybe that's the case, maybe that's not the case, but until somebody stands up, until that mother says, "No, I'm busy, call my husband, he'll come get our child," or until the husband says, "Call me first," or until that employer says, "Look, we want you to realize that, we've got this policy in place that if you need to go to take care of a family emergency, regardless of your gender, we're not going to hold that against you." So to strike that balance that you're talking about, there needs to be a discussion. And that's really the whole purpose of this project that I did, is that, the whole work-life balance debate goes beyond working mothers. But that's how it's largely been framed over the last 40 years, because they've been the tireless advocates. But, you know, I think we can all agree you could be, you know, single with aging parents, and so work-life balance is an issue for you. You could be in a same-sex marriage and have adoptive kids, and work-life balance is an issue for you. So all voices need to be at the table, and I'm just trying to be the one that tells men that they need to be, and tell employers, frankly, that this needs to be considered.
Cameron, I think what we're really dealing with is to redefining what a husband, what a wife is, what a mother, what a father is. And once you've got the definition, that you can work from there. We're working on definitions in today's world that were 30, 40, 50, 100 years old for the most part. Mom did this, dad did this, no matter what it was, there it was. Now, in the last 20 years, women have come to a new position as being defined in the workplace, and there's acceptance there, and there's all those things that everybody's been fighting for. Now, the only thing that we haven't done, and is what you're doing, and let me put a different twist on the words here, is defining what it is. If we define what it is, then there is no, you used the word assumption before. If we define what it is, then there's no assumption of what it's like for mom, what it's like for dad. Oh, dad's got to do it, so is there problems at home, and what kind of a mother is that? If it's defined, if everybody understands it, and to some degree accepts the definition, then we're all on the same wavelength, and we have an even playing field, and we move forward.
That's exactly true, and that, of course, in a perfect world, we'd be able to do that, and that's certainly the lofty goal I think we need to work towards. But of course, the challenge is, depending on your background, depending on your culture, depending on your family influences, depending on, let's face it, on the gender gap between wages, between men and women that still exist out there, there are all sorts of things that get in the way of this. And so it's the old the cliche that until you recognize there's a problem, it's hard to fix it. And so I think that's what's happening. And you see courageous men. You know, in some ways, the first men to do this were the dads that became the at-home fathers. And there's a growing at-home father movement, men who do this by choice, not by, not by job loss. Certainly some come to it through job loss. And in fact, for 15 years now, there's been an annual convention of at-home fathers in various locations around the United States. And these men, in many respects, have been pioneers. But the difference there is that once you become an at-home father, and I've been one, once you become an at-home father, your definition that we talk about, those definitions that you mentioned, becomes very clearly defined. You are the primary caregiver for your children once you become an at-home parent. It's the men who are in the workplace and who are sort of wanting to go to, you know, both sides. I want to progress in my career. I want to show my employer I'm loyal. I want to be worthy of promotion, and I want to be more involved in the raising of my children. And you know, the heads up that I give to employers is that statistically speaking, from a few studies I've looked at and some of the work I've done myself, more men than women are saying that this is an issue. And but again, they're not vocally talking about it. So what happens? That means men are statistically more likely to burn out. They're more likely to intentionally compromise the quality of their work. They're more likely to leave for a different employer who has a perceived better work-life balance offered. And kind of to add the kicker to that is, as the baby boomers start retiring in great numbers and they're being replaced with the 20-somethings, who said that this work-life balance is one of the most, if not the most important things they're looking for. And in particular, fathers in their 20s are now spending more time with children than mothers in their 30s and 40s. So if employers don't start recognizing these trends, then they're going to lose out lose their top talent and miss out on recruiting the emerging new talent to competitors who sort of get this.
So realistically, what we're dealing with is it's the workplace that needs the training, not the mom and dad. The workplace needs the training, and there should be workshops and coordinated between the workplace and obviously mom and dad. But it's the job. It's the job center that needs to be able to define it. Because if I'm going to bring somebody in and it happens to be a man and I expect certain things, and he's got to get off time and again for his family, his wife can't do it, this, I don't care. I don't care, because I'm looking at a bottom line here. And if he gets stressed, then let him get stressed outside the workplace. This is the attitude that you run into. I pay you, you do what I tell you to do. It's fairly well that simple. So this process that you're talking about has to start, again, in the workplace, Cameron.
It does, absolutely. And, you know, already to begin with, there are sort of, at the risk of generalizing, two different types of employers when it comes to work-life balance. There are those who think, you know, work-life balance, work-life schmalance, and 80 hours a week is better than 40 hours a week, and if I'm not seeing the whites of your eyes, then you're not being productive. And then there are the ones who are looking at the economic arguments that are emerging left, right, and center, including one from the Council of Economic Advisors that showed that U.S. industry could save approximately $15 billion annually by adopting workplace flexible, friendly attitudes in the workplace or policies, which mean that people aren't, you know, likely to call in sick, they aren't likely to burn out, they're less likely to do these things that cost employers a ton of money. So it's the progressive ones that are leading the way. But even among those progressive ones, you're right, if they could spearhead the discussion on recognizing, and this is something else that I found, is that you might have a terrific policy, and I'll give you an example. One of the companies that I worked with is called Van City Credit Union here, the largest credit union in Canada. And here in Canada, we have wonderfully progressive policies when it comes to parenthood. In fact, if you're a mother or father, you can take 1 year of paid government leave. It's about 60-odd% of the average salary. And progressive employers will top up a mom's salary for that full year out of their own pockets. And really progressive employers will top up moms or dads or same-sex couples or whomever. But even in those progressive workplaces, what they're not noticing is that because they have this terrific sort of gender-neutral policy in place, men still aren't taking advantage of it for the reasons I mentioned earlier, this concern that if I become identified as that guy who's putting family first, if I get labeled as that guy who's rearranged his work schedule, you know, and people are saying, hey, he's always leaving early to pick up the kids, then you're right. The message that sends to the employer is, well, this guy's not serious about career advancement. And that's where men are hesitant. So, you know, but that conversation, it needs to be threefold. It needs to be employers who want to get the most out of their employees and recognize that this is a smart business move. It needs to come from fathers who are hurting and who crave more time with their kids to have the courage and to wear fatherhood rather than hours at the office as a badge of honor. And I think sort of the forgotten part of this is the angle for moms. And I'm convinced on a personal level and also anecdotally and from the research that until we create a workplace culture where men feel as comfortable as women saying, yeah, I'll work part-time so my spouse can climb the corporate ladder, or I'll work part-time to pick up the slack at home while she pursues her career, and that there aren't jokes and people looking down their nose at men for saying those sorts of things. Until we get to that point, then I'm convinced that women will continue to come up against the glass ceiling. Because for them to make it to the top, somebody does need to pick up the slack at home. And if men aren't willing to do that for a variety of reasons, they're going to keep coming up against that glass ceiling no matter how hard they're working, no matter how brilliant they are.
Cameron, I'm listening very close to you, and I really believe you've got a point. There's no question about it, and there's a tremendous amount of validity to what you're saying. It's where we start with this, because you can get moms and dads and get this feeling, but if you don't get the workplace involved, none of it means anything. So the real impetus has got to come from the base of the workplace to be able to establish this criteria so everybody can experience their balance in this. Because if it's not the workplace's idea, it's not going to work.
Exactly, and that's sort of part of my, obviously, a huge goal of mine. I mean, let's face it, I don't think the average employer is sitting out there at home going, you know, gosh, we need to find ourselves a working father's work-life balance specialist. And so it's up to me to show them the economic argument that this is good, because let's face it, companies, no matter how big their heart might be, it's about the bottom line, and I think anybody who's in business totally understands that. So if we can continue mounting the evidence to show business that this makes smart business sense, I mean, I think any employer will tell you to lose somebody to burnout or to an employer, you know, can cost the business anywhere from 150% to 250% of their salary for a year. That's hard. That takes a hit on the bottom line. And so one of the reasons I'm so thrilled that my two clients here in Vancouver, again, Vancity Credit Union and a company called Clearly Contacts, which is actually the world's largest distributor of contact lenses, and they're being those brave employers who say, yeah, look, we don't have all the answers yet, but we're recognizing this is an issue, and we want to be driving forces in this discussion. And so, you know, I've had a chance to talk with them about some of the things that they can do to internally to make some of these changes. And I think it'll be a real domino effect. You know, a couple of companies stand up, a couple of men stand up, and we've seen stories in the media of dads who've you know, have put their family first and have lost their jobs, and you know, and again, that makes a lot of men say, "Well, I'm just going to keep my mouth shut." But as we get brave souls and progressive, forward-thinking businesses to start making these changes, I think, like everything else, change is slow initially, and then I think you really see a domino effect.
Yeah, but Cameron, again, the problem is not with moms and dads. How do you touch that business? And when you make your presentation, obviously the key is to sit down with them and say, here's your bottom line here. This is what your bottom line could be if you do this. But that's that presentation. That's that knocking on doors. That's that email. That's that flood of PR to get them, number one, to get them interested or get their attention, then get them interested. And I really believe the next follow-up for you would be workshops and teleseminars, because that gets your target out there, enough of them so they can start listening and it's not centered in one area.
Exactly. And you know, I learned early on that to go to the businesses that don't, you know, subscribe to the old school, well, you know, 8 hours is better than 40 hours a week. But, you know, when I get into those businesses, and again, I ask them, you know, how big a concern is recruitment and retention, and you're not going to find a business out there that says they don't care. Even in tough economic times, you know, their businesses are always looking to recruit the top people. That never changes. And certainly with the shift that's going to take place with the mass boomer retirement and the 20-somethings taking their place in the workplace, that supply-demand quickly will shift back to the to workers. And that's one thing I tell businesses, look, if you do not make these changes, you're going to be left behind. And there, you know, there are mountains of volume that make the economic argument in general for adopting work-life balance policies across the line. But even more so as I'm going, and this is a new business for me, but I'm compiling this information as I go, and I'm following up with businesses when I come back to them. But the other thing I show them is these changes that I'm suggesting, and I'm happy to share some of them with you, are ones that cost the company very little. You know, the first thought I think is, oh boy, what's it going to cost to, you know, do we have to completely redo our entire HR, and do we have to, you know, completely restructure our policies and everything else? No, so much of it is just about awareness. You know, the first step I say to employers is the first thing you need to do is change expectations. You know, because a father's at work when he becomes a new dad, don't expect that he's the parent who wanted to come back to work, but maybe he is because he earns more than his spouse. You know, don't expect that he won't be absolutely sleep deprived. Don't expect that when he comes through the door, his heart won't still be at home with his child. And you know, don't excuse me. Expect that everything is going to go right back to normal a day or two after he has a baby. And I'll give you a really good example. This one gentleman who came back to work about a week after becoming a new dad, and his boss called him into his office and said, congratulations, and oh, by the way, I'm putting you on this new job where you're going to be traveling about 10 days a month. And the guy said, well, I can't do that. I cannot do that because this is, you know, I'm not going to be the employee that you want me to be if you do this, and I can't do this for my family. And so, you know, 2, 3, 4, the boss kind of scratched his head and said, okay, and he changed things around again. We'd never dream of doing that to a mother who just came back to work after having a baby. And this is what employers need to recognize, is that by putting men in this difficult situation and not opening up that conversation, they are going to lose out with that productivity and that recruitment and that that retention. And that's something that these businesses really, really need to do. So, you know, we talk in the businesses will often champion mothers, CEOs, you know, top female employees who've done, you know, they've got it all, right? They've achieved the top of the corporate ladder or near the top of the corporate ladder. They've been successful moms as well. Businesses, one of the things I tell them is start championing your fathers who do this, that can strike that balance or are doing things to strike the balance. Another thing companies can do is start measuring success in results, in tangible results, not in face time. Just because somebody's there 60 hours a week and I'm there 40 doesn't mean they're doing more work. It might just mean they're less efficient.
Sure.
So, you know, that's using father-friendly images internally and externally wherever possible. And starting to identify yourself as a father-friendly business in your recruiting and your PR. This is going to attract a new generation of people that get the goal that you want, you know, that you subscribe to the happy worker is a productive worker.
No, by the way, no question, but I think what you're doing is absolutely brilliant because I've heard a lot of ideas, but this is the first time that I've heard anything that went at it with this depth. Cameron, we're out of time. Is there a website we can find you at?
Absolutely. You can go to Better Men, that's M-E-N, bettermensolutions.com, and the contact information is there, as well as the PDF of the full report is up on that site as well.
Wonderful. Hey, Cameron, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Mike. All the best.
Take care. Good night.
Such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many far away places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Patricia Simon with us. She's a successful entrepreneur, sought after speaker, and one of our leading experts in the field of profit management. She's founder and president of David Advisory Group. That's www.davidadvisorygroup.com, a boutique firm that specializes in helping CEOs and small and mid-sized businesses re-engineer their business practices. Let me say the word again. Re-engineer their business practices to generate more profit, cut in efficiency, and optimize their earning potential. And her new book is Six Steps to Creating Profit, a guide for small and mid-sized business, size service-based businesses. Patricia, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, in today's world where there's so many entrepreneurs that are starting small businesses, they're starting to become successful. The big problem is when the outsourcing happened and people had to do something for themselves, there was no one to hold their hand and say, this is the first step. This is how you do it. Just because somebody's in business doesn't mean that they can be cutting edge in the way that they do things. So let me start it out with what caused you to look into this field and get involved in the first place?
Well, I have a computer consulting firm that I founded almost 30 years ago, 28 years ago. And having that firm, I have automated over 1,000 different companies, privately held, service-based, distribution, manufacturing businesses, small to mid-sized. Over these years, I was never ever able to find the kind of advice that I have in this book. I could never find profit information. I could find lots of information on how to be an architect or how to be an accountant or how to develop websites. But when it came to making the hard decisions about how to run a company and to make a profit at the end of the day, I never found anything. So over these years, I researched, put together a lot of material, worked with all those different clients, and I took everything that I had and put it together in this book.
So realistically, you have to know what you're doing. Things aren't just happenstance. They're not accidental. And one of the things that you talk about, one of the first steps, which I think is absolutely critical, is talking about changing the foundation, that foundation of where your decisions come from. It's changed the rules of operation. Most people have no idea what a truly effective operation is and how smooth things can be if you just tweak a few things.
Well, that's true. And if you are having profit problems, if you're losing money, if you're not making money, there are things that other businesses are doing to make money. And sometimes you have to take a step back, just like you would if you were looking at your books at home or your spending habits, and you have to look at everything objectively, maybe with help, and figure out what you could do to make the picture different.
Yeah, and that sometimes takes somebody looking over your shoulder to see what you don't see. You know, everybody has their own unique selling process, and I think the key here is this. You may walk into my business and look at things through different eyes, and you see what I don't see. You bring the invisible up to the table. I can't profit from something that I don't know that's there. And most businesses, they don't need to do anything different. I won't say that. They don't need to do anything else. It's using what they have already and using it to its ultimate, its maximum.
Well, that's true. If there's profit problems, sometimes there's radical changes that need to be made. And sometimes people have been doing things one way for many, many years. They don't even think of another way. But an entrepreneur, someone who's a risk taker, who has a passion for the business that they started, they don't want to lose their business. If something's really at that point, they can really muster up the courage to take a good look and re-engineer things.
And it does take courage, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Yeah, there's so many people are stuck in a certain way of doing things, and they're frightened to death of making that change. The old adage, better unhappy than unsure. Okay, now, one of the most important things today, especially the way the consumers are and the differences in the culture and all of our high-tech technology, it's staying visible, staying connected. People are just starting to get that right now. The old days, 6 degrees of separation, what did you know, 30, 50, 100 people maybe? It's millions now if you know how to do it right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's important with the way things are with the Internet. If you are a business with longevity, maybe you've been in business for 20 years, you have a client base, you have respect in your community, okay? A new guy comes along, puts himself on the Internet, has an email address, a cell phone number, paints a beautiful picture. People looking for those services, they look at you, they see a bland website because you take it for granted that everyone knows you and everyone knows well about you. And then you see this new person with all these fancy credentials and, you know, a big splashy image. And, you know, this is what a consumer is looking at. If you want to compete with this, you've got to compete with it. You've got to show yourself. Be visible. Show you where.
Mm-hmm. And being visible, showing yourself, is not just something that said. It takes other people to show you how to do it. If you are not sophisticated in social networking, none of it's going to help you. And what you do is you augment your skills. And I think that's one of the most important things that people can do in business. If I ever hire anybody, they're going to know more about what it is I'm hiring them mm-hmm. for than I do. And I think that in and of itself is a key.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Okay, now, how do you maximize your cash flow? How do you actually get it to work whereby you've got your base cash flow, but to maximize it, to do everything you can to increase it? And I know it starts from within.
Yeah, I mean, cash flow goes both ways, in and out, of course. One of the things, I work with a lot of service businesses. One of the things that people have to stop doing is making that one sale. You want to create environmental behavior in your company where you are selling a relationship. How do you do that? Well, if we all look around us and see who sells a relationship to us, maybe your landscaper. They do weekly mowing of your lawns. They do fall cleanup, spring cleanup. If you look at other businesses that have that kind of business going on, where they have an ongoing relationship with their customers, it isn't a one-time shot. You don't call someone and say, please come mow my lawn this week. How can you create that kind of a environment in your own business? Some companies have subscriptions. They have maintenance fees. They have selling blocks of time. Maybe you're going to an accountant. He might have a monthly service or yearly tax audit. Whatever it is that you can do to create a relationship with your client so that you're not just getting a one-time sale and then having to go sell that customer again. You're creating an environment where cash is coming in, retainer plans. Anything that can create more than a one-time sale, that's a good thing to do. Of course, on the outside, you need a savvy bookkeeper, a savvy person that's analyzing every payment that's being made. Is it being paid on the proper terms? What's the best terms you can have? Do you have 30 days to pay a bill, and then can you pay it with your American Express card or whatever and have 60 more days? Are you buying things when you need them, or are you just buying them when it's convenient for you to place the order? All of this is very sophisticated and takes a lot of know-how, but you don't want to be caught short with cash. You don't want to need payroll. You don't want to close the doors because you were silly about how you were using your money.
Oh, no question about it. By the way, one of the other things that you talk about, and I think it's extremely important, turn everyone at your company into a salesperson. And another way to say that is get them vested in the company. Get them to feel that they are part of it. Not a profit, percentage owner. But the overall activity in the company, you've got to have those employees feel that they're part of it.
Yeah, I mean, that's very important to me. I've always talked like that and acted like that. You don't want to go to work every day and be a drain on your employer. You don't want to be the one that has to be paid and the one that has to, be in the office even if you don't want them there. What can you do to be an integral part of the business? You want to be happy with customers that call. You want to have your emails with good taglines on the bottom. We all know what it's like to go into maybe a doctor's office. In one office, you might go in and you'll have a great experience. Everyone's welcoming, they're helpful, they make appointments for you. You have a really good feeling when you leave. Then there's the other kind of office where you walk in and everyone's grouchy and giving you a hard time and saying, no, we can't email that to you. We have to call you at home. It's a whole different attitude that goes on when you have a good experience, and that's what you want to have happen with your employees and on behalf of the company.
Now, by the way, a prime example of that happened in the store. What was it, night before last? I was checking out at the counter, and this young woman behind the counter, very pleasant, very warm, very friendly. We were talking. I don't even know what we were talking about. And there was this kid that was bagging the groceries. And I remember as I walked, I looked at him, I said, good night. He didn't even look at me. His mind someplace completely different. And he said, good night. I wasn't there. I didn't exist. And if that's the kind of employee that a particular company hires, you're going to lose business very fast.
Yeah, it's not welcoming. I mean, I go into Trader Joe's. I don't know if they have that across the country, but everyone's helpful. And what do you need? What are you looking for? And I mean, it's part of their job to behave that way, and that's what being a salesperson is about. When you're working for a company, you don't have to be out there getting contracts signed. You're there to have people stay with your business, to want to be there, to come back, to buy things. That's what it's all about.
See, Pat, but at Trader Joe's, everybody who works there is proud of what the product is.
Absolutely.
Products, yeah. And how many times does it happen? You walk into the market and somebody's up there stacking something, and you ask them a question. They're too busy to answer you, and they forget where their paycheck comes from.
Well, that's the point. They're being an expense, and they're not part of the income part of the business. They're not caring whether this company makes money or not. They're just not part of that experience, and that's bad news.
Yeah, and the key is, I'm Michael Ray. I am not associate number 562.377. And I think that's where the problem is, that there's that personal touch that's been lost. And as much as I am for the technological advances that we've made in the last 5-10 years, and it's going to get even better than that as we go along, we've lost that human contact. And it's, and the business in and of itself is nothing more than the people who make up that business.
Yeah, and it's, and it can happen in technology also. I mean, when you send an email to people and you're an employee and it's filled with spelling errors, lowercase, you know, just sloppy, it, what you're saying is, I don't care what you think of me. I don't care what you think of my company. When you have a nicely written email and you promptly respond to something and you have a nice tagline on the bottom, it looks professional, it says something. You know, and quick to respond, not waiting weeks and waiting for 2 and 3 requests, all of those things, whether it's online or whether it's in person, creates the same respect.
Mm-hmm. By the way, where was it that you actually started to see this happening and then decided to take some action?
Well, I've always felt like that. My my own mother had been an entrepreneur and created a catering business, so I grew up with the phenomena of having someone who had their own business, and we would work there, and we had to be nice to the customers, and like we knew that my family would not, you know, get repeat
business. We had to be nice. Hmm? Yeah, I like the way you said that. Let me jump in from, we had to be nice.
Yeah, I mean, we could never be fresh or disrespectful or, sure, you know, tell someone, you know, or ignore people. I mean, because we knew this was our family's business, and this is what it meant. It means income. It means someone's going to hire your family again. It's all about privately held businesses. Now, there's been, over the years in our country, there's just been a little bit of not behaving like that, where people maybe took the jobs for granted. Now, the bad economy in recent years, people are out of work. Maybe they see a different behavior being needed. You really want people to use the company that you work for. You want to have a business. You want to have a job. So this is important.
The other thing to take a look at, too, is the difference in the levels of culture. The new kids coming on board, they speak a different language than somebody spoke 10, 15 years ago. And it's a completely different language. It's in a brand new culture. And businesses also have to learn how to speak to these kids and vice versa if they want to take the time. But learning the language is extremely important also.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a kid...
Yeah, I mean, I have young people in my family that are out in the workplace. I think that they respect the fact that they have a job and they try to do a good job. And that's what we're talking about. Respecting that this is the job that's paying you your salary and doing a good job.
Pat, no question about it. Now, we're running out of time. Let me ask you this. Is there a website we can find you at?
Yes, it's davidadvisorygroup.com.
Okay, it's David, D-A-V-I-D, davidadvisorygroup.com.
Correct.
Wonderful. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I've appreciated your time, and I think the book is great, and especially now the window of opportunity for it with all of these businesses that are startups. And going back to service, it's extremely important. They've got somebody, quote-unquote, looking over their shoulder.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I'm so happy to be with you tonight, and good luck.
Okay, good night.
Well, that's all. Well, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Well, that's all. Well, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. We'll be right back.
There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Vince Bugliosi back with us. He's the author of The Divinity of Doubt, The God Question. Vince's all-time bestseller. He's the author of Helter Skelter, and I'm sure many, many of you recognize Vince. Vince, hi. Welcome back to the show.
It's always great to be on your show, Michael. You're one of the very best.
Thank you so much. Vince, I want to get right into this because I really believe in today's world, with all the confusing and fear-based messages and the apathy that's being created, whether it's got to be political, social, economic, whatever the case may be, a lot of people are confused out there. A lot of people are looking for answers. And if something happens to look good, if it's painted right, then people follow along. So let's start from the beginning. Let's say The Divinity of Doubt, The God Question. What was it, Vince Bugliosi, that caused you to sit back and take a look at this issue and got you the impetus to go forward, research what you did, and come up with what you did?
By the way, let me ask you, Michael, did the publisher finally get a copy of the book to you?
I have it in front of me.
Oh, you have it. Good. Because yeah. I know what we're on the last time you did, so I appreciate that. You finally got a copy. Michael, you know a little bit about me. I like challenges, and I don't think there's any bigger challenge than taking on the God question. And I think I've indicated earlier that I'm more excited about this book than any other book in my entire career. I'm not saying it's my magnum opus, but I've had 7 New York Times bestsellers. 3 got up to number one. And the reason I'm so excited about this book is the subject matter, number one. There's nothing more important than the subject of God. But also, if you look at what's out there now, the barrenness of the religious terrain, and this has been going on for years, nothing really has come down in the last 2,000 years, or certainly within memory, that comes up with anything new. There's nothing new that anyone's bringing to the table. But there's no question, Michael, if you've had a chance to look at the book, there's many things in this book you're just not going to find in other books. And if they were in other books, believe me, Michael, I would not have written this one. So in the book, I examined, you know, I'm an agnostic. It's a book on agnosticism. I examine in depth virtually all the major issues that have troubled mankind through the ages about God, making fresh observations about all of them. And I think at the heart of the book, you could say that I take on many centuries-old religious beliefs that people have unthinkingly accepted as true, and I prove, I believe, beyond a reasonable doubt, that they actually are not true. I meet my burden of proof in the same identical way, Michael, I did in successfully prosecuting, as you know, 106 out of 107 felony jury trials, relying on the evidence. Some of the age-old beliefs I take on, and we can talk about them today based on whether you want to get into any particular area, but I take on and vanquish, among several others, that the Christian God is all-powerful and all-good, that God gives all of us free will, that he is not responsible for how we exercise his free will, that God answers prayers, that there is life after death because the soul supposedly is immortal, that Jesus was born of a virgin, that when we die it's because of old age or illness, that intelligent design proves there is a God, that atheism is at least a respectable philosophy, and so forth. I believe I successfully rebut all of these notions in my book.
Okay, let's talk the Bible for a moment. And by the way, Vince, I'm not a Bible scholar. But the Bible in the old days, when the Bible was first written, it was done in metaphor. It was done symbolically, because if the thoughts that were behind the Bible were out in public, then those people who wrote it would have been killed. I mean, there's no question about that. And I think the big problem is we took something that was symbolic, brought it fast forward to the future, to now, and people are trying to literally interpret a symbolic writing. And I think there's where a lot of the confusion is. They didn't take fact on. What they took on was assumption. The assumption had an incontestable conclusion, couldn't prove it wrong, so they took it on as fact, and there was too many people living their lives based on what they thought was fact, which wasn't truly provable. And if you take a look at the definition of God through, you know, Judaism, Christianity, if you go to any one of the religions, which the Muslim, you're going to find a completely different God. And how can it be a different God when there's that all-powerful being that sits up there, quote unquote, and dictates how the flow of the universe is going to go? How do you get different definitions? So how can it all be the same thing?
Well, that's an impossible question. How do you have different definitions of God? Because you have different people interpreting God. So obviously you're going to have different definitions. But you said it started all out originally as means symbolism. I'm not sure about that. You may have read that somewhere, and you may be true what you say, but I don't think that is true. If you look at 2 Timothy 3:16, it's the belief, I thought, until you just mentioned what you just did, that every single word of the Bible is inspired by God, and there's literally billions of people who believe that. Now, you say it's all symbolism. If it's all symbolism, that means that nothing ever happened, and the Bible is just fraudulent and just a book of fiction, and it's only allegorical, as opposed to setting forth things that actually happened. I believe that many things in the Bible did not happen. On the other hand, I believe the Bible is a book of enormous wisdom and profundity and cannot easily be dismissed. But I think you said, maybe I read you wrong, Michael, that these books were written and they were all supposed to be just symbolic. In other words, when they were writing about Jesus dying on the cross, they really didn't mean that. I think the people that wrote these books, I think at least a lot of them, believe what they wrote.
Oh, okay, no question about it. But Vince, we're also talking about something else here. We're talking about, which has to do with the topic, we're talking about a language. The Bible was written in a particular language, and I don't mean Russian, English, whatever. It was written in a language, and it was written in an emotional, mental language of the day. We speak a different language today, and I think where the big problem is we don't have a bridge between the two languages to really interpret what the Bible means. You know, you go back and look at...
there's no way that I can help you on that, Michael. These are books that have been around for centuries and centuries, and they've evolved. And I can tell you this, that when we do find old copies of the Bible, they vary very little from previous copies that we've had centuries earlier. There's not that much difference, but you're saying that there's quite a difference between the words that were used originally and now. There's no way I can help you on that. I'm not a biblical scholar, but I do have common sense, and I do know how to evaluate evidence on important issues. But I can't help you on your saying that it was written in a certain language, and now we have a new language, so we can't understand it. I can't help you on that, Michael.
Okay, let me say it a different way, Vince. 25-30 years ago, there was a culture here in this country. And based on that cult, the society and that breeded the culture and the way we looked at things, the way we felt about things, the way we did things. I'm going to take you back to the 1950s. I was brought up junior high school, grammar school, junior high school, the majority of the 50s. We had a certain culture. We had a certain way we thought about things. We had a certain way that we lived and a certain way that we interpreted. Now, you fast forward to today. That's a different language. You know, we were aliens compared to what the kids are learning today. That's what I meant about the different language. As time goes by, the thought, the mindsets, the thought patterns change.
Yeah, well, I don't think there's any question that what you're saying is correct, but I don't know where it goes, which is a trial term. I don't know where it goes. Are you suggesting then that we jettison the Bible?
No, what I'm suggesting is this, that the literal interpretation of the Bible has caused a lot of problems with a lot of people. And when they've created the literal translation out of fear, there's a lot of people who have controlled people. That's where I'm going with that. If the language was different, a lot of the things that were written wasn't meant to be the way that it's used today and practically applied.
Okay, but assuming that what you say is true, how does that help us now at this particular point? What do you suggest we do because of what you say? Assuming it to be true, where do we go from here? I can't help you on this.
Okay, and by the way, I love this because this is just going to go off the top of our heads. I would recommend that we got a focus group, all right? And when I say a focus group, the top, not necessarily the top people in the different religions, but those that were, let's say, middle management of the different religions and actually sat down, came to the table values neutral, instead of saying who's right and who's wrong, construct together and become aware of a way that we can all live together under the auspices of spirituality of whatever God means. Then we speak the same language.
Okay. I can't help you on that. I've said this now for 3-4 times. I repeat again. I have no, assuming that what you say is all true, there's, I don't know where it goes. I don't know how to help you. I can tell you this.
Well, I'm coming from conjecture.
I can tell you this. If we get rid of the Bible, you automatically get rid of Judaism and automatically get rid of Christianity. They cannot exist without the current Bible. That doesn't mean that it's correct. I'm just telling you, neither religion can exist without the Bible.
And by the way, this is all conjecture for me.
It's all conjecture on my part?
No, my part.
Oh, yeah. But you do agree that without the Bible, you don't have Judaism or Christianity. You agree on that?
I completely agree. It's the foundation. It's the base.
That's right.
Yeah.
But there are questions that people have asked for centuries and centuries, and many of them, they think they have the answer to these questions. And in my book, Divinity of Doubt, in many areas, I prove that these centuries-old beliefs are not true based on the Bible, based on the Bible. For instance, let's just take one. You hear over and over and over again, God gives all of us free will. And if you challenge someone on that, like my wife did about 2 weeks ago to a lady friend, she said, it's in the Bible. Well, I found out that contrary to popular belief, the Bible does not say there's free will. It says the precise opposite, that there's no free will. And I don't have to tell you the enormous implications of this, Michael. How do you explain God's punishment of evildoers if what they did was preordained by God? They had no choice. Now, again, to differentiate between the Bible and my view, if you were to ask me, Michael, do I believe there's free will, I can tell you what my answer would be. My answer would be, why are you asking me? You may just as well be asking my neighbor or the local grocer. I'm just talking about the Bible here now. The Bible, if you look at it closely, says there's no free will. And I'll just give you a couple quick citations to prove my point. Isaiah 63:17 says, Lord, why do you cause us to stray from thy ways? That doesn't indicate free will. Romans 11:32 goes so far as to say that God, quote, consigns all men to disobedience. Talking about the interpretation now, as you indicate, of words in the Bible, Talmudic scholars have been struggling, not just for years, but for centuries, trying to get around the clear language, I think, in Exodus 4:21, where God tells Moses, I will harden the heart of the Pharaoh, causing him to be stubborn, so he does not let the people free, referring to the Israelites in Egypt, supposedly then justifying his imposition of the 10 plagues on the people of Egypt. Now, the scholars have done everything possible to actually interpret these words not to mean what they clearly say, that he did not give, he took away the Pharaoh's free will. Did the Pharaoh have free will? I have no opinion one way or the other on that. I'm talking about the language of the Bible. The Bible says no free will, and yet Christianity and Judaism believe very, very strongly that there is free will, and believe it or not, they say the Bible says that, but when you ask them to come up with evidence, they stay away from the issue the way the devil stays away from holy water. One thing they do say to me on talk shows, they say, well, Mr. Bagliosi, you're picking and choosing. There's many other places in the Bible where free will is strongly indicated, and I say, well, I have my pencil and paper here. Give these citations to me, and in the next edition of the book, I point out, I will cite your reference in the Bible. But they do say that, that there are other references. But here's where I get them. I say, how do you feel about Martin Luther? And they say, well, Martin Luther was a great man. I mean, he founded Protestantism. I said, what would you say if I told you that Martin Luther says there's no free will? They say, well, I wouldn't believe you. So I read to them from De Servo Arbitrio, that was his magnum opus, it's Latin for On the Enslaved Will, which he wrote in 1525, And here's what he says, Martin Luther. Not that he's correct, but here's what he says. He says that, quote, God foreknows and wills all things. He foresees, intends, and does all things according to his own eternal and infallible will. This, Luther says, quote, knocks free will flat and utterly shatters it. He says man's will is free only to the extent of doing, quote, the will of God, that man himself can do no good except through God's grace. Now, when I read that to them, they have to pause. And you see, when I'm talking about biblical citations, they can say, well, there's others that say the opposite. But they can't very well say, well, that's just one Martin Luther. There's other Martin Luthers that you don't know about that have said something else. And the only thing they can say and what they say, well, I'm going to have to read that book. The current title of the book is called The Bondage of the Will. But here's a classic example of what I'm talking about, Michael. I take something that's age-old in its belief that God gives us free will, and I don't say whether or not there's free will because it would be silly for me to say that I know, but the Bible doesn't say that. And I give many other examples in my book where long-standing beliefs that people no longer question, I do question them, and I apply the evidence. The evidence is my only guide, it's my only master, and I come up with a completely different conclusion, and everything that I say, you've read some of my other books, I support. Whether you feel I'm right or wrong, you have to say that, yes, you have some support for this, Mr. Pagliosi.
No question. Vince, let me jump in just for a second, because, and before, conjecture for my part, I'm just flowing with what I'm hearing you say.
Yes.
From my perspective. All right. I want to talk about free will for a minute. I would venture to guess if you ask anybody on this planet who's got free will, they're going to say something like, you know, the United States has it, this has it, that has it. Not so. Because if you open your mouth today, you get sued, you don't get free will. And look at all the dictatorial directions that countries take. They take over the population. They nationalize it. And what does that do? It takes away free will. So what you're saying is true. I don't know anybody anywhere that truly has any free will. You open your mouth, it's going to cost you.
Yes. But people do say that God gives us free will. Now the other argument they say, which flows from that, is that God is not responsible. You've heard this, for how we exercise our free will. That's a classic Christian argument. When you point to something like the Holocaust or any horror or atrocity, they say, well, these people had free will, and God's not responsible. And my take on that is this, that let's assume that Hitler, Stalin, what have you, they had a choice between good and bad, and they chose bad. This does not exonerate God for a couple reasons. One, God is also supposed to be, according to Christianity and Judaism, omniscient, meaning he knows what people are going to do before they do it. He's also all-powerful, meaning that he has the power to prevent these things from happening, and yet he allowed these horrors to take place, like the Holocaust. Yet people come back and say, well, I still don't believe what you're saying, Mr. Pagliosi. He's not responsible for what they do. And then I give them this example, and here's where they have trouble. I say, let's take parents, and they have a child, let's call him Eddie, 17 years of age, and he lives with his parents. And Eddie is robbing, raping, and murdering people in his part of town. The police don't know about it, but the parents do. And they have the power to stop him. And I ask these people who are questioning when I say that God cannot absolve himself of culpability because supposedly these people had free will. I said, what would you think of these parents if they said, well, you know, Eddie's got free will, and we're not responsible for how he exercises it, so we're not going to stop him from doing what he's doing or even try to stop him. I say, what would you think of these people? Well, they have to pause, obviously, and they know they've been had. And they say, well, these parents would be terrible human beings. And then I ask them, well, then why don't you treat God the same way? And some of them come back and say, well, Mr. Pagliosi, you're comparing apples with oranges. How can you compare a human with a transcendent being? And then I point out, well, whether the person or the entity is transcendent or human, they're doing precisely the same identical thing. They're allowing horrors to take place. They could stop the horror, and they don't do it. That makes them bad. And then I also point out that their argument goes in the wrong direction. It's not even helping them, because if God is transcendent and supposedly all good, all the more so, as they say in the law, a fortiori, all the more so he should intervene and prevent the evil. I mean, no one is claiming that the parents are all good. So this is the type of thing that I do in Divinity of Doubt. I take things right back to their source, like immortality of the soul. I went all the way back to Plato, where it all started, and I find that there's pure moonshine for a lot of this stuff. There's no solid support, either in evidence or logic.
Now, by the way, Vince, when you move to these things, And you're right. There can't be evidence. There can't be logic in it. There can't be any of it. I would venture to guess that I would say a lot of the religions are very much likened to the government. You've got a bureaucracy, which is the wall between the government and the people. The bureaucracy, in many cases, in different religions, is that church or that place of holiness, and or what they call holiness, and the spirituality of the people that believe in a certain way. You got people making rules, and those rules have nothing to do with the Bible, and there's a lot of control. I swear to you, on one Sunday, my sister and I were watching television, and I flashed by this, there was a gospel preacher on, and he was on, Vince, he was on like you wouldn't believe. And in the background, I saw it and almost fell off my chair. It said, and he's asking for money now. It said, miracles are not guaranteed. You hear it?
What's the last thing you said?
Okay,
he was asking for money, you said?
Yeah, wait, no, the guy's asking.
I can hardly hear you. It's the what he called is not clear here, but go ahead.
Okay, wait, let me do this. Okay. How about
I
that?
Can hear you, but it's not clear.
Okay.
Anyway, he's preaching one thing, and in the background, he's asking for money.
Okay, he's preaching, and he's asking for donation. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, yeah.
Okay, he's preaching, he's asking for donation. There is a sign behind him, and the sign said, miracles are not guaranteed. So if you send your money, they can't guarantee anything will happen.
Yes.
Yeah, but okay, that's all faith. And so that's the key. I've watched these things time and time and time again. And most importantly is to realize that some of the people doing this that are living an opulent lifestyle, and they're taking the money from the people who can barely make it and have enough food on their table. So in the name of religion, there's too many people who have done too many wrong things.
Yeah. Now you take a person like Billy Graham, who has not done that. He's led an ethical, honorable life. I read about Billy that he has never taken any fee for any of the speeches he's given. He's spoken to more people, I guess, about God than any other human in history, over 100 million in person. But the problem with Billy, like I say in the book, a lot of people say the book is very, very funny, in addition to being insightful. The problem with Billy is that Billy is silly, okay? Billy, for instance, knows the dimensions of heaven, right down to the square mile. So Billy's silly. He's a good man. He's a good man. He's honorable, but he's silly. And here's the other problem with Billy. He is the main spokesman for born-again Christianity. Born-again Christianity is virtually, I'm sure I'll be offending some people here, but I can't pick and choose my words. It's the insane belief that no matter, and Billy says this, no question, there's no ambiguity here, no matter how good a life you lead, no matter how good you are to your fellow man, no matter how ethical and honorable and good you are, if you do not accept Jesus as your Savior, you're going to hell. I mean, he says that in his book, How to Become Born Again. Doesn't make any difference how good you are. So apparently God is more concerned, under born-again Christianity, he's more concerned about whether you accept his Son as your Savior than he is about how you treat your fellow man. Now, if this is not a blasphemy against reason, Michael, I don't know what is. But on the other hand, reason only visits those who welcome it. Your audience should know, Michael, that even though I'm savaging theism, I'm not easy on atheism at all. I view atheism as an intellectually barren, almost a vapid philosophy whose current prolocutors, I'm talking about people like Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins, these people, if you look at what they say, and I could give you so many examples if we have time, they cannot find a non sequitur, Michael, that they do not like. It's just one non sequitur after another. There's no substance to atheism. I don't know whether or not there's a God, of course, but I can tell you that if there isn't, atheistic dogma does not lead one rationally to that conclusion. At least theism has the argument of first cause, which is very difficult to get around. I am not agnostic, by the way, as far as the Christian God. The Christian God, by definition, cannot exist. He's a contradiction in terms. But that does not mean that there's no supernatural creator who created the universe, and you can call that person God or that entity God. But the Christian God obviously cannot exist because the two virtues that they ascribe to him, Christianity ascribes to him, among others, is that he's all-powerful and all-good. Now, he can be all-powerful and he can be all-good. He can't be both of them at the same time because they're irreconcilable virtues. For instance, if he's all-powerful, by definition that means, and we've already alluded to this, that obviously means, if he's all-powerful, that he can prevent evil. And yet, we know that he has allowed in the past and continues to allow unspeakable atrocities and horrors to take place, like the Holocaust. So this immediately tells us that he cannot be all good. Likewise, if he's all good and wanted to prevent the Holocaust, but he couldn't, that would mean he's not all-powerful. So the bottom line on the Christian God is that if Christians insist on having a God, they certainly can do so. But if they have any respect for logic, they're going to have to redefine who he is. No way you can come up with a satisfactory rationalization to say he's all good, and yet he gives the green light, and he could have stopped it with a wave of a hand or whatever, to 6 million people being murdered. No way you can speak common sense and reach that conclusion.
And by the way, Vince, the Quran basically said the same thing, you know, believe my way or die. And I think that what we've been brought to is a state of fear. Fear controls people. Fear controls people to such an extent that they will do anything that they can do to be in somebody's good graces. That I believe very strongly, and I don't know what to call it anymore. We'll call it God. I can't label it. I can't define it. I can't put it into a package and say, this is what it is. And the people who can sometimes are very scary because you don't know if they really know what they're talking about. And we talked about this last time. How do you define the undefinable? And if you can, something's wrong.
Yes. Well, that's one reason why I'm an agnostic. And I think I mentioned last time, if I didn't, I'll mention it today, Gertrude Stein's non-literary articulation of agnosticism. There ain't no answer. There ain't going to be any answer. There never has been an answer. That's the answer. We're dealing with an internal mystery here, and Clarence Darrow said, I don't purport to know what ignorant men are sure of. We can probably reduce this whole discussion about God down to the simple question, is there a God, you know, who created the world, or is God, Michael, just a word that we use to explain the world? But in either event, God should only be a question, and yet there's all types of people out there who seem to know that there's a God or there isn't a God. Around Christmas time, they don't know what to buy their members of their family because they don't know what they want. They don't know if it's going to rain or shine tomorrow. They don't know what happened to that paper they lost or misplaced yesterday or what's right around the corner, but they seem to know whether there's a God up there or there is no God. I actually envy them. I wish I had that type of knowledge, but I think the intelligent approach is that of Einstein, that the problem is too vast for our limited minds, and that's why I'm an agnostic. I don't think either theism or atheism has met their burden of proof. Of the two, theism offers more evidence of a God than atheism offers evidence of no God. But I'm comfortable in being an agnostic for the simple reason that there's no evidence, strong evidence, to convince me one way or the other.
Now, by the way, when we deal with this, and I know that that you've addressed this in the book, God in Court, very interesting, because when you really take a look at it, we live in a land that we are supposed to be ruled by the rule of law. Nobody knows that better than you do as an attorney and the experience that you have. That's starting to wane at this stage of the game. And when you start to put God into the courtroom, into the system, and people are swayed by the name and the fear, you get people deciding things that they wouldn't normally have decided that way because they're afraid not to say it. You know, if you think this way, God hates you. God will get you. You know, and I don't believe in a God that's vindictive and vengeful. Then how could that be God? That's human.
Yes. But the Bible, we have to separate the Old Testament from the New Testament, but the Old Testament God was an extremely vengeful entity. Not vengeful is too good for him. He was a monster of the first order that would put the villains of history to shame by comparison. I mean, here's a guy a guy, I'm being cute. Here's an entity that murdered the entire human race, and in a kind of a nice way. I mean, he was a sweet guy. He drowned them. I mean, you know, if you're going to choose horrible ways to die, is there too many worse ways than drowning? So I'm going to pour rain on the earth for 40 days and nights. I guess he wanted to make sure that no one held the air in their lungs long enough to survive. He murders the entire human race other than Noah and his family. And believe it or not, if you talk to people who are really religious, they find some justification for that. But my view is that if murder isn't wrong, then nothing's wrong. So we have to separate the Old Testament God, who committed one atrocity after another. He told Joshua, the successor of Moses, to murder all men, women, children, and babies, everyone in 31 kingdoms that were hostile to the Israelites. I mean, just a horrible, horrible human being. And yes, Judaism, and to a lesser extent Christianity, they actually worship that incredibly monstrous, murderous God. Now, you have to distinguish, of course, between the God of the Old Testament and the God of the New Testament, which is Jesus. Jesus had many extremely high moral characteristics, one of which is his concern for the poor. They tell the story in Matthew, it's a parable, that a young man, actually it's not a parable, they cite it as having taken place, that a young man who was very wealthy wanted to follow Jesus. And Jesus said, well, you're very rich, you give everything that you have to the poor, and then you can follow me. I mean, he's the one, Jesus in Matthew, who said that if someone hits you on one cheek, then turn the other cheek and let him hit you on the other cheek too. One interesting thing, however, there's one area, Michael, where the God of the New Testament, i.e. Jesus, is almost, you could say, more monstrous than the God of the Old Testament. People know it, but they don't know it. I mean, they don't speak of it in the way that I'm going to speak about it right now. And that's in this notion of born-again Christianity. The born-agains, by the way, did not make this up. In John, the book of John, they talk about the fact that if you're not born again, you cannot go to heaven. So here's someone who clearly says in the New Testament, I'll give you one citation, Mark 6:16, clearly says that if you don't accept me as the Son of God, you're going to be condemned. In other words, condemned to hell to burn forevermore. And as Robert Ingersoll, I don't know if you've heard that name, he has not received the credit he deserves, but he was one of the great minds of the 19th century. He was a lawyer, he was a logician, a great mind. He pointed out, he said, you know, the God of the New Testament, Jesus, when you die, that's just the beginning of your suffering, a suffering that goes on without end. He says, at least the God of the Old Testament, when he had you dead, he let you alone. So in that respect, Jesus, as moral as he was and as completely different as he was from the Old Testament, in that one respect, he was worse than his father. Supposed father. You know, the Holy Trinity, you've heard all that nonsense, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. They're all the same, but they're all different. And as Tolstoy said, you can utter those words that they're all one, but they're three. He said, but you can't believe them because they make no sense.
You know, there was something that most people have not got. It wasn't Jesus Christ. It was Jesus the Christ. And Christianity didn't come around for about 100 years after Jesus died.
Right.
So there's some interesting things to look at there. The other thing, too, which I thought was interesting when we're dealing with religions, etc. Go back to the Second World War. Hitler had a plot to kill the Pope, because Hitler was going to take this political Nazism and he was going to make it spiritual. Nazism was going to become a religion. The Pope was standing in his way. There were too many people believed in the Pope, etc. So the plot got stopped, but Hitler was going to create his own religion. And I think one of the great religions that we should discuss, and I don't know if you've addressed it now, not then, I'm almost saying this tongue in cheek, is Scientology. I mean, you pay X amount of dollars, you get in there, and when you get to a certain level, you pay some more money, you get to a certain level, and then you get a space being that takes you over from that point. Now, people believe this. People are paying money, hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not more, to let somebody from space take their body and move forward with their quest.
Yeah, Manson was a Scientologist at one point, but then he left. I did not know. I did not know until you just said it right now that Hitler planned to kill the Pope. You're aware that the Pope did not speak out against Nazi Germany or the Holocaust.
Right.
Although there is abundant evidence that the Vatican did everything possible to save many Jews, hiding many of them actually within the Vatican, but. The Pope had the moral authority at that time to possibly do something against Hitler, speak out. He never did. He was as silent as a church mouse. But I did not know until you just mentioned that that Hitler planned to murder the Pope. I did not know that. There wasn't too much of a need for it, except, like you say, to start a new religion, which, again, I did not know. I did not know he intended to start a religion of his own, but he didn't have too much need for murdering the Pope because the Pope was not opposing him, at least not publicly.
It wasn't necessarily
not speak out against Hitler. That I do know.
Yeah, Vince, it wasn't necessarily the Pope. It was what the Pope represented, the control the Pope had over the Catholics.
Yeah, and very interesting. I want to look into that.
The swastika. That swastika is the Star of David in reverse, if you look at it.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, it's unbelievable with what people have done, quote unquote, in the name of God. People have been killed, people have been murdered. And I once did a show probably 20 years ago, and I had a rabbi from the rabbinical Union College coming up from Los Angeles. I was up in Fairbanks in those days, and I had a Catholic priest and I had a couple of people from different denominations. And the question that I asked to start it out was very simple. What do you think Jesus Christ would say if he was walking down the street today? And what do you think he would say to the way people use his name? That went on for 2 hours solid. And it's the same thing with God.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
If I say God, then you can't debate me. Because if you debate me, then you're talking about God. And that's what, look at it politically today. Look at some of these groups, the followers that they have. If you don't believe my way, then you can't be in the group and you can't be part of this. And that causes a lot of people to move forward, even if they don't believe what they're saying.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, arguably, the greatest deception of the last two millenniums has been organized religion's attempted and largely successful preemption of morality. Indeed, they say that morality needs religion. But I believe that morality, thank you, can stand very well on its own two feet. It doesn't need religion or anything else to prop it up. But no example has to be given for this obvious proposition, Michael. But, for instance, Scandinavian countries are deeply secular, and organized religion and church going are marginalized. They're almost ridiculed. One person in Denmark told a researcher, in Copenhagen, he said, you'd rather run through the streets of Copenhagen or Hagen naked than mention the word God. Yet are we to believe that the people of countries like Denmark and Sweden and Norway are less moral than we are here in the United States, one of the most religious countries in the world? And to that I would just say, please, just please. But on the other hand, like you're indicating, we absolutely know, Michael, from the corrupt popes of the past, like the Borgias and the many corrupt evangelical preachers of today, and mostly, of course, from the horrible, devastating wars throughout the centuries that have been fought in the name of God and religion, where millions of humans have been slaughtered, that religion does need morality, that we do know. The interesting question is whether or not, on balance, religion has been good or bad for human beings. I'm not a historian, so I would not weigh in on that. But there is no doubt that throughout history, religion also has done some good. Frequently is, in addition to breeding intolerance, which is bad, has caused a tremendous amount of goodwill down through the years, encouraging, you know, that you treat your fellow man under the golden rule, and is also given a sense that we are here for a reason, that life is not an empty accidental adventure, and religion has given people equanimity and strength to overcome the fear of death. It's contributed much to the poor, a lot of charity. But whether it's a net force for good or evil through the years, there's no way that I would weigh in on that. I do quote in the book Thomas Huxley, he's the one that came up with the word agnosticism. Let me read to you what he says about it in an essay he wrote in the 19th century, if I can find it here. He tried to weigh in on this issue. Is it a net force for good or bad? Here's what Thomas Huxley said in his essay, Agnosticism, 1889. He says, I verily believe that the great good which has been effected in the world by Christianity has been largely counteracted by the pestilent doctrine on which all the churches have insisted, that honest disbelief in their more or less astonishing creeds is a moral offense, indeed a sin of the deepest dye, deserving and involving the same future retribution as murder. If we could only see in one view the torrents of cruelty, the lies, the slaughter, the violations of every obligation of humanity which have flowed from this source along the course of the history of Christian nations, our worst imagination of hell would pale beside the vision. So Huxley is saying that on balance, religion has been more of a force for bad than for good, but there's no way for me to weigh in on that issue.
By the way, Vince, your chapter 14, what's so great up there in heaven? I've got an answer for that. You ready?
Yeah.
Okay, no, 78 virgins if you go blow yourself up in a crowded bus stop.
Yeah. That's right. They actually believe that. You're talking about the Islamic fundamentalists and the extremists who...
Absolutely. Why would God tell you to do that? And that's another example of what you were talking about in the Bible early on about, you know, believe my way or die. And you see, that in and of itself doesn't make any sense. And do I say there's no God? I don't know. Vince, I really don't. But what I do know inside of me that there's a something. That's the motivating force that moves me forward. I don't think that I'm going to meet 78 virgins up in heaven, etc. But I do know that if I lead a decent life, I'll be fine. But for whatever comes, my feeling is this, that we talk about integrity, which is a very interesting word. Integrity,
yes,
for you and I means that from inside, we export that externally. So what we feel inside, that's how we are outside. But when integrity means that if your daughter looks at somebody that you don't like and you take her out in the backyard and you cut her head off and it's okay because that's part of God's law, then they're also showing integrity. So integrity is based on time and place.
Yeah, well, that's a very sophisticated, nuanced definition, which is something that I would expect of you, Michael. Yes, I agree with what you're saying. You know, we were talking about the Twin Towers and these people flying into the towers thinking that they're going to end up with virgins. An interesting thing about prayer, when something like a catastrophe, like 9/11 happens,
yes,
what do people do, Michael? They immediately run to their church, synagogue, or some other place of worship to pray for the victims and their loved ones. The very entity who allowed or caused the horror to take place. And they actually get comfort from praying to the very entity that caused or allowed, at least allowed, the entity, the horror to take place. To me, Michael, you may disagree with me, but I think this can almost be categorized as dementia. How do you get comfort praying to the entity, which at a minimum allowed the horror to take place? I don't understand. I could see people praying to God and cursing God and saying, God, you are evil for what you did. Please don't do it again. But how do you get comfort by praying to the entity that caused the horror to your loved ones? As I say, I don't know how you feel about that, but that's going towards dementia, because Christianity, all of the theologians across the board, they all agree that God either caused or allowed everything to take place. They have to do that, because if they don't agree on that, then they're saying God is not omnipotent, he's not all-powerful. Pope John in 2005, writing about the Holocaust in his 2005 book, said, quote, God allowed the Holocaust to take place. Billy Graham, talking about Hurricane Katrina, said, I don't know who caused it, but God allowed it. And yet, we go for comfort to the very entity that caused or allowed these horrors to take place. I don't know what your view is on that, but to me, it's approaching dementia.
And by the way, there's an answer to why people run to certain places. Vince, we're taught. And that's really realistically what it is. And the end result, this is what we're brought up with. This is what we're taught. This is how we respond. And if we don't respond this way, something bad's going to happen, et cetera. And, right. and that's realistically what it is. My feeling is if you've learned something, you can unlearn and you can relearn any kind of an alternative that you want to learn. But I really believe that what you're saying is true. You take a look at what all of this has caused. Now, I can't say that, you know, God's a horrible entity, yada, yada. I don't know whether or not that's truly the end result of I'm going to call it purpose, because what I really believe is this: you get dealt a hand of cards when you're born, and you got a certain hand in your hand, and you get to play it the way you want to play it. Right. And I don't think God in the Word, I don't think God ever says no. You want poverty? Yes. You want wealth? Yes. You want misery? Yes. You want happiness? Yes. If free will is here, you get to choose the kind of life that you want. Now, you may not consciously choose those things that I've just mentioned, but unconsciously it's there because you're making up for something you've been taught that you don't deserve. I mean, this list goes on and on. So, yep. In essence, everything we do is a learned response.
Yes, yes. Well, that's the power of divinity of doubt, that people have believed so many things throughout the centuries, and people who are reading this book are confronting for the first time the strong opposite view that's supported not just by an opinion, but by evidence and logic. Interestingly enough, quite a few people have told me, Mr. Bugliosi, I found out who I was by reading Divinity of Doubt. I used to think I was an atheist, or some say I used to think I was a theist, and I found out that I was neither. I was an agnostic, and I didn't know it. And they find that learning their true identity, religious identity, is of some value to them. But still talking about prayers, just about everyone, or at least 95 out of 100 people, pray. And if you pray, that means that you think that you might get something in return for that prayer. My view, and I think I think I proved my point, is that apart from the placebo effect, prayers are completely useless, that two working hands can achieve far, far more than 100 million coupled ones. I write a whole chapter on prayer, and if I can just briefly summarize it, if people pray, Michael, and get what they prayed for instance, maybe they're praying for a promotion at work, and they get that promotion, you know what they say. They say, God answered my prayers. But if they say that, if we're going to use logic, if logic is going to govern our thoughts, shouldn't they then say to themselves, wait a while now, if God answered my prayers, this automatically means that God has the power to answer prayers. He's all-powerful. He has the power to answer prayers. And then shouldn't they go to the next thought? And if he does have the power to answer prayers, and he's up there, how can I possibly say that God is all good when I know, absolutely know, not think, but know with a 100% certainty that if he's up there and he has the power to answer prayers, he nearly always turns down the praying party when that party needs him the most. Like the millions of Jews who prayed to him during the Holocaust, like the millions who prayed to him among the incredible 25 million people who have already died worldwide from AIDS, and the millions that have died from genocide and starvation. The fact that we know, not think, the fact that we know that if there's a God up there and he can answer prayers, the fact that we know that he turned these millions of people down, telling them in effect, Michael, you know, I couldn't care less, take a walk, shouldn't that tell us, Michael, that God not only is not all good, but that he doesn't answer prayers, and if we happen to get what we prayed for, it had nothing to do with God, but was traceable to some other reason. I mean, if God answers prayers and he's all good, why doesn't he ever answer the prayers for peace? I mean, there have been literally billions upon billions of prayers, Michael, as you know, for peace down through the years, yet groups and factions and nations, they persist in warring viciously with each other, the violence continuing unabated. There's supposed to be some religious sect in the Himalayan mountains that I read about years ago. I don't know how long ago, 5, 10, 15 years ago, I read an article saying that this sect has been praying for peace continuously for close to 500 years. I read in the New York Times about a year ago about the nuns of the Franciscan Sisters in La Crosse, Wisconsin, that have been praying in 30-minute shifts continuously since 1878 for peace. Now, wouldn't one think, Michael, that these people would finally come to the realization that either there's no one up there listening to their prayers for peace, or if there is, he doesn't, you know, have the power to stop the violence, or if he does, he has no desire to do so, that they may just as well be praying to a tree trunk. And yet people continue to pray for peace, billions upon billions. I don't know what they're thinking. Are they thinking that maybe their prayer, out of the trillions that have been said, is going to be the prayer that's going to so-called break the camels, or whatever that term is, break the camels back? What's that term?
Break the camels back.
What's the term?
Break the camels back.
Yeah, break the camels back with God, and he's going to say, okay, you finally prayed enough. I'm going to give you your peace. Or do they actually think, Michael, that their prayer might cause God to answer? In other words, he might answer their prayer alone. In either event, and this is part of the sarcasm in my book, I say, in either event, you have to know this is not insanity. It's beyond insanity, and I'd like to go up to these people and ask why they're praying, but I don't because I'm afraid to go near them. So I try to inject humor throughout the book a little bit in the way of sarcasm, but this constantly praying for peace and never, ever, ever, ever getting it, and supposedly God's up there and he's all-powerful and all-good, I don't know how you add these things together. If you use
Vince, let me hold you up. I've listened to you very closely. Let me tell you what came up for me.
Okay.
Two things. One is, the first thing is that we talked about we don't really have free will. We do have free will. It's not up to him to say you're going to die, you're going to live. It's up to us to not to be in the wars. It's up to us.
And we may have free will, yeah. Yeah,
and not to go out and kill people and on and on and on. Because I truly believe that if it really comes down to it, and I'm listening very closely to you, and I think you're spot on with so much of this, but it all boils down to free will. We have the ability not to kill. We have the ability not to go to war. We have the ability to feed somebody when they're hungry, and it goes on and on and on. So it's the free will that we're saying it's somebody else's responsibility, and I'm not going to take responsibility for making the decision to not to go out and not kill, quote unquote.
Right.
Small example of that would be somebody in business. You want to make money, you shut your mouth, and people's houses get taken away, but it's okay, you made a couple of bucks. That said, the biggest challenge that you're going to have with all of this is basically this, that when it's got to do with brain chemistry. And when I say brain chemistry, if somebody is afraid of not believing a certain way, or if they stray from what they've been taught, the minute that they hear something different, there's an actual chemical transition that goes on in the brain. There's an automatic defense, and they totally shut off. So
right,
it's got to be said in such a way that it moves beyond that mechanism that causes the problem. It's got to come from, instead of the front part of the brain, the back part of the brain and the bottom, so that that pain or pleasure area of the brain releases the kind of chemicals that cause you to feel good about what you've heard. That said, so it's moving beyond and saying in such a way that they can relate to it on a personal level. But the other thing, what I've got more than anything else out of this, the one thing that we are not is we are not responsible for our actions. And you've seen what's going on. It's always his fault. It's her fault. It's their fault.
Oh, yeah, of course.
But that's the free will. Why would I have to make a decision when I can blame God for it? So in essence, we do have free will. We're not using it.
Yeah. Well, what you're doing, you're making a common sense argument for free will, and I don't reject it. I wanted to make clear from the very beginning, I'm not saying there's no free will. All I'm saying is that people think that the Bible says there's free will, and if you look at the Bible closely, it says no free will, but I'm not saying that. You just made a good, powerful, strong, common sense argument for free will.
Yeah.
But Christianity, as well as Judaism, they say that we do have free will, number one, but they say that the Bible says this, that God gives us all free will, and it's in the Bible. It's not in the Bible. There may be free will, but it's not in the Bible. The Bible says the opposite. That's all I'm saying.
And if the we're in agreement, and if the Bible says you have free will, whatever Bible that it is, then exercise it. We're not doing it. That's where the problems are coming from. We are not standing up for quote-unquote what we believe in because we're afraid that if we do, something's going to happen. I'll give you a prime example. I'll exaggerate. The kid comes in and you say to your kid, tell me the truth. And the kid says, nah, tell me the truth. The kid tells you the truth, you whack the kid. Now, you have a politician. The politician says something. You say to that politician, tell me the truth. They're not going to tell you the truth because why? They're afraid you're going to whack them. How do you whack them? You don't vote for them. This is all learned response, Vince.
Well, you know, we've kind of been focusing on theism, and most of my book is about theism, but I do want to go back just for a moment about atheism.
Please.
Because there's a lot of atheists out there, and I feel that their philosophy is vapid. I just want to give you a couple examples of their non sequiturs. I could give you many, many examples. They say that if there's a God, then how do we have all the horror and the evil in the world? Well, that suggests that God has to be all good, which is a non sequitur. He doesn't have to be. Theoretically, he'd be all powerful without also being all good. Another non sequitur of theirs. They believe, as you know, Michael, that God did not create man, that man evolved from some, you know, original life form, a bacteria somehow evolved into Mozart. But you see, that presupposes that God, if there is a God, did not create the original life form, and then evolution took over from there. The big non sequitur out there now in the atheistic community, embraced primarily by Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris in their books, they've come up with this ridiculous proposition that if they can slay the dragon of organized religion, which to me is not a worthy opponent, they have therefore slain God. I mean, it's very, very clear from their books. They're all about knocking out religion, and they think if they've knocked out religion, they've knocked out God. But that presupposes that you cannot have God without also having religion, which is too ridiculous a non sequitur to even comment upon. In 2010, a national Pew poll confirmed something I already knew, but I didn't have the numbers. The Pew poll said that over 30% of those Americans who have no connection whatsoever with organized religion still believe very firmly in God. Obviously, the antithesis of God is no God, not no religion. So these atheists are out there with their bombast and supposed intellectual profundity, but at bottom, all they have is one silly non sequitur after another. And I told you that at least theism has first cause. Do we have time to get into first cause or not?
Oh, I've only got 3 minutes, and guess what? We're going to have you back on.
Well, let me just briefly talk about first cause.
Okay,
we've only got
about 2 minutes.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, we've only got about 2 minutes to go, and it was a very rapid hour. So,
Ahead. Well, you're very intellectually stimulating. You're asking good questions. Yeah, we're going to need more time on it, but it gets into quantum mechanics and the Big Bang Theory and all that, but it's basically cause and effect. You know, Aquinas said that everything in existence, a shoe, a box, a peach in a tree, has to have been caused by something else, and that thing in turn by something else. But the belief is that this regression in the chain of causation cannot go back into infinity. It has to go up against or go back to something that was not caused by anything else, something that was independent, and Aquinas called that the first cause, the uncaused cause, if you will, and religion calls it God, this first cause, and the atheists and the scientists try to knock it down with quantum mechanics and Big Bang. I don't think they succeed in doing it, but we don't have time to get into that. Now, Michael, it's always a pleasure appearing on your show. I mean, you do your homework, you've got a great mind, you ask great questions, and I'm always honored to be on your show, and I wish you the best in all the years ahead.
Hey, Vince Pugliosi, we need a website where we can find you and buy the book.
Well, I'm still in the 19th century with a yellow pad and pencil. My publisher, Vanguard, I'm sure has a website out there. I don't know what it would be, but I don't even have a computer or a cell phone. But Divinity of Doubt, is the God Question. Is you can get it, of course, in stores throughout the country. It's also on Amazon.com, I think, for only about $15. Believe it or not, the ones that are savaging me the most on the Internet, and I don't have a computer, but people send me printouts, the atheists. The atheists are savaging me, telling people not to read the book. I don't know what I'm talking about. So they're going after me more than the theists are.
Hey, Vince, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you, Michael. It's great being on your show. I really appreciate it.
Take care. Good night.
Good night, Michael. Take care. Bye.
We're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after. They've torn down these dusty.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
If I had this to do again, and the evening were new again, I would spend it with you again. But now the curtain falls. People say I was made for this.